The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Jory Slodke for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Discover. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the double March-April 2021 issue. We begin with our cover story, When Shame Goes Viral. This ancient social emotion has always been complex. The internet poured fuel on it, then came social media. When Monica Lewinsky emerged in 2014 after a decade of quiet existence, she had a message to share. She also had a master's degree in social psychology, earned in London where she hunkered down for grad school. Vanity Fair printed her exclusive first-person comeback story in 2014. Then she took the stage to tell of life after becoming that woman in one of history's most widely broadcast sex scandals. I went from being a completely private figure to a publicly humiliated one, worldwide, Lewinsky says in her 2015 TED Talk, which now has more than 18 million views. I was patient zero of losing a personal reputation on a global scale, almost instantaneously. The infamous 1998 incident with President Bill Clinton occurred at the dawn of the internet age, a fact not lost on Lewinsky, who says her name has appeared in almost 40 rap songs. Her actions as a 24-year-old intern went viral pre-social media. In recent years, the rise of Facebook and Twitter and the potential for public shaming on the internet motivated Lewinsky to speak up. A marketplace has emerged where public humiliation is a commodity and shame is an industry, she says in the video. One can only speculate whether Lewinsky would have been met with criticism or empathy on today's digital stage. In some cases, this internet-based outrage culture results in positive change. It has exposed grave offenses, elevated political movements, and toppled abusers in the U.S. and beyond. Hollywood giant Harvey Weinstein, for example, was ousted, charged, and imprisoned on the heels of the widely broadcast Me Too campaign. For better or worse, the internet and social media have significantly amplified humanity's means of public shaming, taking victims from the town square to a global network of connected screens. The internet now allows hundreds or thousands of people to participate in collective shaming in a way that wasn't possible before, says Takuya Sawaoka, a social psychologist and research director at Open Mind, a psychology-based educational platform. The result is a steady flow of new names and targets, both high-profile and everyday citizens, flooding our media feeds and rage scale. Some call it cancel culture. Others embrace it as a social reckoning. Whatever you call this new wave of public shaming, researchers are evaluating whether the ancient emotion is benefiting or harming humans today, and to what extent. The results may hold some keys to our collective future. Long before the internet, people who violated moral codes in a society would get fastened to a pillar, stocks, or pillory, a device in which the offender's head and hands were locked in a wooden frame. The masses would gather to taunt and jeer them, hurling rotten food at their heads along with insulting words. This dual punishment and spectacle, aptly named pillorying, started more than 1,000 years ago in parts of Europe, and it lasted well into the 19th century when, you could say, it got canceled. It's worth noting that this practice was eventually outlawed because it became regarded to be too cruel, Sawaoka says. England fully abolished the pillory by 1837, along with many nearby countries and most U.S. territories by that time. The state of Delaware was a last holdout in the Western world, outlawing it as recently as 1905. Whether or not it involves a literal pillory, Shame has generally run parallel with human civilization and social order through the ages. Some anthropologists and evolutionary psychologists make the case that shame is universal and biological, as an evolved mechanism to ensure our survival. The idea is that adaptations favoring group cooperation and mutual aid stretch as far back as early human foragers, according to a 2018 study published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences. Researchers suggested that feelings of shame in an individual are nature's way of encoding the social cost of human behaviors, such as stealing. The study tested this idea in 15 remote independent communities around the world and found the same patterns in each. Considering how societies are built on norms and hierarchy, a 2020 study published in Frontiers in Behavioral Neuroscience framed shame as an evolved disease avoidance architecture, wherein the emotion helps to protect individuals from undesirable social circumstances, such as being an outsider to a group. The study presented some evidence that shame may be linked to disgust. In this case, disgust directed at the self as a source of contamination for the group. While experts continue to probe the origins of shame, many contemporary psychologists classify it as a self-conscious, moral emotion associated with feelings of powerlessness, worthlessness, and other psychological turmoil in the individual. Maybe it's this thing that came from group-level processes and certainly had its benefit, but it can really wreak havoc on the individual level and make things worse, says Michael Slepian, a social psychologist at Columbia University. Slepian's work builds on a popular theory in psychology that guilt, when compared to its relative, shame, takes on a distinct role in the human psyche. Essentially, guilt stirs feelings of regret or remorse toward a specific incident or behavior that has affected someone else. Shame, on the other hand, brings up broader feelings of worthlessness and self-judgment. That's the key distinction between guilt and shame, says Carnegie Mellon University organizational psychologist Taya Cohen. You did a bad thing versus you are a bad person. For example, if you post an angry rant about a friend on social media, you might feel guilty and later apologize. A so-called shame response to the same situation would make you feel like a horrible, worthless person. Slepian says he questions whether there's any healthy place for shame today. I don't know whether making people feel small and powerless and helpless is ever a good thing. Just as Lewinsky was patient zero for instant global humiliation, Justine Sacco in 2013 became a poster child for viral Twitter shaming, now common practice on a platform built for rapid-fire input, often criticism, from the masses. Minutes before boarding an 11-hour flight to South Africa, Sacco posted a tweet to her 170 followers that permanently changed her life. Going to Africa. Hope I don't get AIDS. Just kidding. I'm white. By the time Sacco landed, tens of thousands of people had responded to and shared her tweet. The hashtag, #HasJustineLandedYet, went viral around the world, with a barrage of criticism calling her racist. The moment was fueled in part by the fact that she was airborne and would remain oblivious to the fallout until she reconnected to the internet. She also worked as a senior communications director, which created the perfect storm of irony and internet memes. Sacco was immediately fired from her job and became the subject of endless articles and a book. One of the overwhelming questions in her case, and many similar instances, is to what degree any single blunder should define a person's reputation, and when does Twitter shaming, or any pile-on of criticism towards someone, become bullying? As you might expect, it's complicated. One of the problems with social media is that it's devoid of context, says Lisa Feldman Barrett, a neuroscientist and psychologist at Northeastern University, and author of How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. This is compounded by the fact that social media doesn't always allow for same back-and-forth discourse that people use in real life to talk about their problems. Instead, platforms such as Twitter and Facebook are mostly designed for broadcasting, she says, rather than actual communication and exchange between people. It's mostly about speaking, and it's not very much about listening. However, public moral outrage is not always aimed at reforming a specific offender. The goal might be solidarity with a victim, group, or cause, and shifting cultural attitudes in anyone witnessing the outrage. The person who has done the offense, say Harvey Weinstein, may be a lost cause, Cohen explains, but by making him an example, it sets the standards for our society, moral codes, what is acceptable and non-acceptable behavior. Feldman Barrett's research has dug deep into the specific cultural context where emotions play out. She rejects the popular notion that feelings of guilt are universally healthier than shame, calling this a very Western view. Instead, she says that shame means something different in more collectivist societies, like those found in the East, versus individualist cultures in the West. The American way tends to be, you're a piece of expletive for what you did. You should feel really bad about what you said, maybe to the point of being worthless, Feldman Barrett says. I think the way that shame is wielded right now in this American way is meant to punish. By contrast, shame in some cultures, like in Japan, Taiwan, or some parts of Africa, is not about blame or punishment. In Taiwan, according to a 2019 paper in Frontiers in Psychology, children are often shamed as an expression of love and moral guidance. It's about connection and repairing and honoring a relationship, Feldman Barrett says. The Twitter and social media masses often rally against racism, sexism, and other behavior rooted in bigotry. If you examine cultural movements such as Black Lives Matter and Me Too, you will find specific offenders being shamed, along with challenges to broader organizations like police departments or political parties. Some research shows that collective anger can also be a unifying and effective force for systemic change. Outrage may even be necessary, suggests Victoria Spring, a postdoc fellow studying moral emotions at New York University. Martin Luther King Jr. and Malcolm X were both angry about racism. Gandhi was angry about British imperialism in India, Spring says. All of them were outraged about injustice, and they were able to transform that into activism. King even made a call to awaken a sense of shame within the oppressor in his 1957 speech, The Power of Nonviolence, as a means to reconcile with them. Spring highlighted collective action as one common outcome of outrage in a 2018 paper published in Trends in Cognitive Sciences. Researchers found a compelling example of this in a 2011 study when they observed how women exposed to hostile sexism rallied to participate in collective action for equal salaries. Meanwhile, exposure to benevolent sexism, or affectionate and chivalrous forms of male dominance, decreased women's intentions to engage in political action, according to the study in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology. Spring says social media does seem to complicate our relationship with outrage, because humans are still figuring out how to leverage the phenomena of having such a vast audience. We're constantly weighing the costs and benefits of saying something or not saying something. In related work, Sawaoka and colleagues recently identified what they call the paradox of viral outrage in a 2018 paper in Psychological Science. That work showed how the pile-on effect of online shaming can actually trigger sympathy towards an offender, even when their mark or misstep was grave. We find that the more people who participate in collective shaming, the more this shaming can start to look like bullying, Sawaoka says. Commenters who criticized the initial offense were also viewed more negatively when they were seen alongside a barrage of other shaming replies. The exponential dynamics of internet postings make this expression of legitimate individual outrage appear excessive and unjust, wrote the researchers. Online shaming can become ever more complex when the target is the culture at large. Or, say, the history of racism and slavery in the U.S. Exposing these matters and their effects can spark an array of reactions in individuals. If I identify as an American and I believe America is great, then it's very difficult to acknowledge something that runs counter to that identity, Cohen says. People will do whatever they can to avoid acknowledging that. They may even turn to shaming people on the internet. It's a vicious cycle. Dealing with digital shame. Some argue that shame can be a powerful tool for change when wielded against powerful figures and institutions. But when it's weaponized against others in shared digital spaces, these same tactics can morph into insidious behaviors like cyberbullying or online harassment. Getting called out, insulted, or bullied isn't exactly new, but the internet's ability to amplify and permanently document those messages is. And this tool is now in the hands of most young people. A 2020 report by the Cyberbullying Research Center shows that 95% of U.S. teens are online. Most tweens, ages 9 through 12, have personal devices, and 9 out of 10 of them use social media or gaming apps in the past year. Here's how experts recommend guiding kids and teens through this digital landscape. 1. Think before you post. In the digital age, what we share can become permanent. It's also a way of presenting ourselves to others, says web safety expert Nancy Willard, author of Cyberbullying and Cyber Threats. In short, consider what your social media footprint says about you. Write down the keywords that you would like other people to use when they describe you, Willard says. Then, when you're posting something, ask yourself, does that reflect those qualities? 2. Work through scenarios in advance. If someone lashes out at you online, says Justin W. Patchen, co-director of the Cyberbullying Research Center, you might feel the desire, even the need, to respond. Instead, parents and educators should consider helping their kids prepare them for such situations beforehand. Give them a situation, he says, to just practice those skills of deflecting, ignoring, or even making a joke of it. 3. Stop and stay calm. It's easy for even subtle digital clashes to make your blood boil. If you're upset, realize that the threat response center of your brain has taken over, Willard says. Unfortunately, when this happens, your emotional regulation and your thinking centers go offline. But there are ways to remain zen. Take some deep breaths. Step away from the keyboard. Go for a walk outside. 4. Put yourself in the other person's shoes. If you're being belittled online, it may say more about the other person than it does about you, says psychologist Sherry Turkle, founding director of the MIT Initiative on Technology and Self, and author of The Empathy Diaries. If you can keep that in mind, she says, then the whole experience will seem less bewildering to you emotionally. 5. Empower yourself with tools. If you do find yourself or your child being cyberbullied, often the tech itself can provide a number of simple ways to respond: blocking the offender, reporting hurtful exchanges, taking screenshots, saving message threads. Patchen says having that evidence can help if the behaviors do escalate beyond one hurtful offense to repeated, long-standing harassment. It's a lot easier for authorities to get involved when they can see exactly what's going on, he says. The land of living snowflakes. One of America's rarest birds lives on Alaska's loneliest island. Scientists are finally exploring their private kingdom. St. Matthew Island sits alone in the frigid emptiness of the Bering Sea, like a great gnarled stone thrown far from Alaska's western coast. On these shores, the rhythmic lapping of brisk waves and a medley of tinny, chime-like songs are the only sounds rising above the island's foggy, treeless crown. The songs come from male Mackay's buntings, brilliantly white birds that drift to the earth in graceful, sweeping arcs. The birds' bewitching mating ritual and nesting occurs only here, in one of the most inaccessible places on the planet. Precious little is known about their world. Researchers are aiming to change that. The ornithological community's knowledge of Mackay's buntings, the only bird with a range completely contained within Alaska's borders, dates back to the bird's discovery in 1879. Naturalist and author John Burroughs, while on an 1899 expedition to Alaska, was smitten with the male bunting's displays over the tundra of Hall Island, a small satellite off St. Matthew's Glory of Russia Cape. Drifting over this marvelous carpet, he wrote in 1901, or dropping down upon it from the air above, was the Hyperborean snowbird, white as a snowflake and with a song of great sweetness and power. Named after naturalist Charles Mackay, who first collected specimens of the bird, these buntings are so evocative of winter flurries that for many years they were known as Mackay's snowflakes. I actually like the original name better, says Stephen Matsuoka, a wildlife biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Alaska Science Center, who studies the birds today. Since their formal description in the 1880s, these rarely seen birds have eluded in-depth study. At 32 miles long, St. Matthew Island is uninhabited, its undulating sea of cold, stunted grass and moss only broken by the ghostly tines of reindeer antlers affixed to bleached skulls. The introduced reindeer briefly crowded the island decades ago, but have since died out, leaving ceaseless wind as the most frequent guest on the island. Alaska's noted for being a remote wilderness area, and even among Alaskans, St. Matthew is held in regard because it's the hardest place to get to, says Matsuoka. There's no regular air service. It's 250 kilometers, or over 150 miles, from any settlements. The island wilderness is so isolated that two decades passed between expeditions to the McKay's Bunting's breeding grounds. In the early 1980s, researchers visited St. Matthew to learn about the bird's nesting habits. Then, in 2003, another group of scientists returned to estimate the bird's numbers. Results from these surveys suggested that there may be more than 30,000 McKay's Buntings, 10 times more than previously estimated, according to Matsuoka. Despite this, McKay's Buntings could be the rarest bird in North America, says Rachel Richardson, another wildlife biologist with the Alaska Science Center. The birds are potentially vulnerable, too, given that they depend on such a small island area for breeding. Evaluating possible threats, like invasive species and climate change, on this island is paramount for safeguarding these living snowflakes. In the summer of 2018, another team of researchers, Richardson among them, returned to the breeding grounds, spending 5 weeks on St. Matthew's, studying the birds' nesting habits and potential conservation threats. Getting out to the islands is really no small feat, says Richardson. The team had to access the Bunting's Haven from an already far-flung locale, St. Paul, part of the desolate volcanic Pribilof Islands, which are a 3 to 4 hour plane ride from Anchorage. From there, Richardson and her colleagues boarded the RV Tekla, a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service research vessel. After 28 hours of nonstop voyaging over whipping 12-foot seas, the wind-carved undulations of St. Matthew and Hall Islands came into view. That's a pretty incredible thing to witness, Richardson says. Volcanic islands just pop up on the horizon. On St. Matthew, an uninhabited wildlife refuge, no structures break the rolling expanse of low grasses and sedges. The team made camp with a series of weather-resistant tents, outfitted with kerosene heaters for warmth and propane stoves for cooking. They sheltered on the subarctic tundra, enduring rain, thick fog, and wind. What seemed harsh and empty for the researchers turned out to be lavish for Bering Sea wildlife. They found spotted seals sprawled out in the shadow of towering sea cliffs, cacophonous seabird colonies, and prowling Arctic and red foxes. But no creature was more abundant than the mouse-like singing voles darting through rocky fields of talus, jumbles of rock fragments broken off the surrounding cliffs. The tiny rodents pierced the air with alarm calls so frequently that it almost feels like you have tinnitus walking around the island, says Matsuoka. Those rock fields of the island are also the Bunting's domain. There, above the uneven terrain, the researchers watch the males perform. It's quite lovely, says Richardson. The males flit upwards, locking their wings out flat and floating back down, singing all the while. And they'll do that over and over and over again. Each time they land, they usually land in the same spot. In the week before the team settled on the island, they worked from the research vessel, taking a skiff to different stretches of craggy coast, walking across the breadth of St. Matthew, spotting the Buntings and recording their locations with GPS to build a map of their habitats. Thankfully, the white bird's stark contrast against the brown and green tundra made them easy to identify and count. Beyond the head count, more data was waiting beneath the team's boots, in tiny nests filling crevices between the massive boulders. McKay's Buntings make excellent use of their austere surroundings, turning a forbidding tract of boulders into a nursery. To take a peek at these well-hidden sanctuaries without damaging them, Richardson and her colleagues got creative. They used borescope cameras, tiny LED cameras situated on the tip of long, flexible hoses, often used in plumbing to see in tight, winding spaces. After watching a bunting dive into the talus at a specific location, the researchers would feed the borescope into the rubble labyrinth to light up and view the nests. The team counted eggs and tracked the development of hatchlings without moving a single rock or touching any birds. Weeks of peering into St. Matthew's talus fields gave the researchers new data on nest survival rates and breeding timing, which they compared with previous surveys. Very few of the nests failed in 2018 compared to 2003 and the 1980s reports. Predators only devoured a small fraction of the hatchlings. This suggests that the island's red foxes, thought to have colonized the island about 20 years ago, haven't been hurting the birds' numbers. Richardson says that the foxes can certainly dig and move some boulders to access nests, but nests deeper than the crevices in the crevices may have an advantage, something the team wants to investigate in the future. Curiously, the buntings seem to be nesting earlier and earlier in the spring. In the 1980s, the median date that the birds laid their first egg was June 27th. In 2018, that had shifted weeks earlier to June 5th. Warming of the Bering Sea may be to blame. Climate would be one of the things that you would suspect, Matsuoka says. He adds that the nesting habitat has apparently changed too, with past records showing buntings nesting on the beach and in driftwood logs, which was not the case during recent visits. This may be because much more upland habitat is available now, thanks to earlier snowmelt. When the team briefly returned to the island in summer 2019 to finish surveys, they noticed some buntings were still nesting as late as August, a period normally considered post-breeding season for Alaskan songbirds. Matsuoka says these birds are either re-nesting after an earlier failure or having a second nest in the same season. The latter scenario would be strange. That's fairly common in temperate and tropical systems, he says. It's quite unusual in northern areas. Going forward, the team hopes to make the bunting surveys far more regular to better capture the population's trajectory and to figure out what the birds do in winter, other than sporadically turn up along Alaska's sparsely inhabited western coastline. If the buntings are declining, filling in details about their annual life cycle could prove crucial. Gathering newer information on the bunting status, says Richardson, tells researchers more than just how the birds are faring. It's important to get a handle on what's going on with the buntings and really understand what's happening in the Bering Sea region as it is being faced with all of these rapid climate changes, she says. It would be appropriate, after all, for the herald of a sweltering sea to be a living snowflake. We've run out of time for today's episode of Discover. Be sure to listen next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Jory Slodke, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Discover is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call area code 919-832-5138. That number again is area code 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.